it is gone. A two-run home run for Rhys Hoskins into the second deck for Bryce Harper. Swing and a miss. He got him. And Aaron Nola leads two. Segura on the run. Reaches up and makes the grab.
Swing and a miss. Struck him out.
Now batting for the Phillies, John Stolness.
Hey there, podcast pals, and welcome back to another edition of Hittin' Season. This is episode number 316. I'm John Stolness from SB Nation's Phillies blog, The Good Fight. You can follow me on Twitter, at John Stolness. Coming up, we're going to talk about the first three games of the Phillies' four-game series against the Cincinnati Reds. We're recording on Wednesday night before the Thursday afternoon game, so hopefully much of what you're about to hear won't be dated by the time that you hear it. But we're going to talk about the Phillies stumbling on Wednesday night in the third game of the series after taking the first two games. We'll look at a couple of pitchers the Phillies decided not to sign in the middle of the season and how helpful they would have been. Bryce Harper's turned his season around. We'll talk about that. We'll talk a little bit about Scott Kingery, some possible call-ups for the month of September, and I'm going to talk to Matt Winkleman from Phillies Minor Thoughts and Baseball Prospectus on Johnny Almaraz and a little bit about Spencer Howard. Plus, I will have your stat of the week. But before we get into the show, just want to remind everybody that we have some bonus content at the Hittin' Season Patreon. I've got a brand new Cards on the Table video up there for you to check out. So we'll do a mailbag for Patreon members coming up here in the next week. Maybe we'll do it for Sunday night. We'll do a mailbag edition on Sunday night for Patreon listeners. So if you are a Patreon member on the $5 a month tier, make sure to send in an email question and a mailbag question, and we'll do it on the show on Sunday night. In the meantime, go to patreon.com/hittinseason to do that and sign up on the $5 a month tier and get some of that bonus content. And if you haven't already, tell a friend about the Hittin' Season podcast and the Good Fight podcast feed where you get continued success and the Dirty Inning, and you'll get all that stuff if you go to Apple Podcasts and subscribe to the Good Fight podcast feed and leave a rating and a review while you're there. All right, let's get into this Phillies versus Reds series. And after winning the first two games, the offense was cooking in Cincinnati. Looked like the Phillies might be starting to get on a little bit of a roll, but every time we start to get a little bit excited about this baseball team, they kind of pull the rug out from under us a little bit. The Phillies went into their start on Wednesday night, Aaron Nola taking the mound for the Phillies, having won three in a row, and they needed to keep up the pace. I mean, the Chicago Cubs were idle on Wednesday night, so they had a chance to get it to two games, but Aaron Nola, for the first time in a long time this season, really struggled, was only able to go four innings in this ballgame, gave up five runs, six strikeouts, three walks, and the Phillies ended up losing 8-5 after mounting a valiant comeback. The Phillies really need to win these Aaron Nola starts down the stretch if they expect to get into the playoffs. If they are going to get into the postseason, if they're going to go on a run, and they're going to have to go on a run. In their last 10 games, they're 5-5, and they've been treading water, playing 500 ball basically for the last 2 weeks, and they've dug themselves enough of a hole here in the wild card race that they can't afford to do that. They have to sweep the bad teams that are in front of them, because as we mentioned on episode 315 that I did with Liz Rocher, the September schedule is brutal. After this Cincinnati series, they play 20 straight games against winning teams, and they only have 9 games left at home this year, so the vast majority of their games are going to be on the road against winning teams. A lot of them teams in their division, like the Braves, Nationals, and Mets. So they have to take advantage of these games against Cincinnati, and they did in the first two games, but when they had an opportunity to take the third game and push the winning streak to 4 with Aaron Nola on the mound, for the third Aaron Nola start in a row, they failed to secure a victory. That's huge. And as Scott Lauber from the Philadelphia Inquirer noted, he did some math which talked about the Phil's need to win the Aaron Nola starts coming into the game on Wednesday night. He noted that the Cubs are on pace for 88 wins this year. If the Phillies go 6-0 in Nola starts, they would only need to go 10-9 in the other games to match the Cubs' 88 wins. If Nola goes 4-2 in the last 6 starts, they would need to go 12-7 without him. So they'd need to go 5 games over 500 in all of the non-Aaron Nola starts in order to match the Cubs' projected win total of 88 wins. And so the Phillies have lost 3 Nola starts in a row. So, again, if Nola wins the last 5, the Phillies will need to go 11-8. In all of the non-Aaron Nola starts. They would need to go 5-1 in the Nola starts, and then would need to go 11-8 in all of the other non-Aaron Nola starts. It just feels like too steep a hill to climb. If they'd have taken business in the Aaron Nola starts, in the two previous starts where Aaron Nola pitched really well but the offense failed to come through, they would be in much better position. They'd be in much better shape. Unfortunately, Nola was not sharp early in this one. His ERA now at 3.63 on the season. He hasn't had a bad season this year. It's just been very up and down. A very, very slow start for Nola. I think he was getting used to the new baseball this year, but just had one of those nights tonight where he couldn't locate. And that happens with him every now and then. The ERA of 3.63 is still good in this day and age of inflated ERAs and homers flying all over the place. But in this all-important game, it wasn't just Nola that struggled. What the Phillies have in the bullpen right now also should lead you to believe that it's really going to be hard for this team to go on a run, because this was a huge game. This was a game the Phillies absolutely had to have. And these are the five relief pitchers that Gabe Kapler had to go to try and get him through this game, to try and keep the Reds at five runs, and they couldn't do it. Cole Irvin came in and actually pitched very well. Jared Hughes, Jose Alvarez, who has been outstanding for the Phillies, gave up his first home run since May after the Phillies had tied it up at five. The very next half inning, Alvarez gives up a solo home run to make it 6-5. Blake Parker comes in and gives up a couple of runs, a two-run home run to an opposing pitcher, Michael Lorenzen, who is not he doesn't hit like an opposing pitcher. He's played some outfield this year. He's an amazing athlete. There's no shame in giving up a home run to Lorenzen. And then Nick Pivetta came in to finish off the eighth inning for Parker. But, I mean, you've got Jared Hughes and Cole Irvin and Blake Parker and a struggling Nick Pivetta pitching important innings, late innings, in a pennant race, a game you have to win because this is all Gabe Kapler has. I mean, I have criticized Gabe Kapler when it's been called for, but there's only so much the guy can do when his ace pitcher can only give him four innings. And Kapler was correct to remove Nola from the game when he did. But the problem is he has no bullets in this bullpen right now in a pennant race. There have got to be better options. Matt Klentak did not do enough at the trade deadline to get this team another couple of relievers just to get them through to the end of the season. And I was not all over Matt Klentak for failing to go out and get a high-priced item, a big-ticket item, because I didn't think this team was really in a position to get something like that. But to not get something competent so that you don't have to have Jared Hughes and Blake Parker pitching games this late in the season as your seventh, eighth inning options didn't really give this team much of a chance in games like this. And so this is what you get. This is what Matt Klentak gave Gabe Kapler. So you can't blame Gabe Kapler for this one. I mean, this doesn't fall on him. This falls on the front office not giving him the bullets that he needed to get the job done tonight for when Aaron Nola had an unusually bad start. So this was a game, again, another Aaron Nola start the Phillies were unable to secure, and they've got to win all of them. They've got to win all of them. They have one good starting pitcher, one, and they've lost the last three starts that he's had. They're just not going to win the wild card doing that. There's just no way they can do that. By the way, nice job by Adam Haseley, though, in the eighth inning to rob Freddy Galvis of a home run. This was an entertaining game on Wednesday night. The Phillies came back from 5-0 down after Nola dug them a hole. You had a two-run home run from Logan Morrison. You had a two-run home run from JT Realmuto and a solo home run from Jay Bruce to get them back to 5-5. Unfortunately, Michael Lorenzen hit that two-run homer late to seal the win. But it was an amazing grab by Adam Haseley going over the wall to rob Freddy Galvis of a home run in the ninth inning. It looked like he was going to save the game and help keep it a one-run lead. And then, unfortunately, Parker gave up the home run to Lorenzen, and that made it a three-run deficit, and that was pretty much it for the Phillies. They went quietly in the ninth inning. So after taking the first two games of this series, the Phillies find themselves three games behind the Chicago Cubs for that second wild card. The Arizona Diamondbacks now just a half a game behind the Phillies. The Brewers one game behind the Phillies, and the Mets a game and a half behind the Phillies. All those teams within 4.5 games of the Cubs for that final wild card, but the Cubs are starting to put a little bit of distance between themselves and the Phillies and the rest of the National League crew as they are trying to chase them down. Phillies got to win games like this if they want to catch up. You got to sweep some bad teams. That's just the way it is right now. And look, the Phillies are trying to finish the season with the players they have, but Did they miss the boat on not getting Craig Kimbrell and or Dallas Keuchel? I think you can make the argument that Dallas Keuchel would have been a very good addition for this team. I was more interested in the Phillies going out and getting Kimbrell at the trade deadline, and who knows how much better Kimbrell would have been. I'll get to his numbers in just a minute, but I noted this on Twitter. Keuchel has a 3.72 ERA since joining the Braves rotation. That was on June 21st. Looking at all other Phillies starters' ERAs since June 21st, Keuchel's 3.72 ERA would have been the second best on the team by quite a lot among Phillies starters during that stretch. Nola has coming into Wednesday night's game, Nola had a 2.21 ERA since June 21st. That, of course, went up a little bit. Drew Smyly's ERA since June 21st, 4.75, a full run higher than Keuchel's. Vince Velasquez, 4.97. Vargas, Jason Vargas, 5.18 since June 21st. Jake Arrieta, 5.73. Zach Eflin, 7.68. Now, I know Eflin's been better as of late. That ERA has actually come down a bit. So that tells you how much Eflin has been struggling. But if you have Keuchel in there instead of any one of those five pitchers, you have a number two starter. You have a number three starter who's masquerading as a number two starter, but it certainly would have been a lot better than Smiley's 4.75, Velasquez's 4.97, Vargas's 5.18, and Eflin's 7.68. And Stephen Gross noted, former Phillies beat writer from McCall Sports, that if you take out one clunker from Keuchel, I think he gave up, he had like an 8-run outing a couple of starts ago. If you take out one big clunker from Keuchel since joining the Braves, he has a 3.00 ERA in 13 starts. And in the four games since he got batted around, he has a 1.08 ERA in those four games with a 3.14 FIP. So Dallas Keuchel would have been helpful. He would have been useful here. And if you're going to go out and you're going to trade for Vargas and you're going to sign Drew Smyly, both of them soft-tossing left-handers, I don't see the opposition in signing Dallas Keuchel at the trade deadline, or not at the trade deadline, before the draft pick compensation period ended, and they could sign either Keuchel or Kimbrell without having to give up a draft pick. He was available to everybody. Phillies could have nabbed him, and they were in the market for soft tossing lefties very, very soon after that. A month after that time period ended, they went out and got Vargas and Smiley. Doesn't make sense to me when all Keuchel would have cost you is some cash, and you wouldn't have had to really sign him for all that much of a commitment. And then with Craig Kimbrell, I mentioned Kimbrell a little bit on the previous Hit and Season pod I did with Liz. He had a terrible outing on Sunday, and his ERA on the season is now 5.68. So he gave up 3 earned runs in his first 3 outings, and he had a terrible outing in which he gave up 4 runs on Sunday, cost his team a victory. But in the 17 outings in between, he had a 2.30 ERA and opponents hit 193 against him. So Kimbrell, for the vast majority of his appearances, has been good, but he's had some clunkers in there too. So I don't think you can argue that Kimbrell wouldn't be better in this particular spot than Blake Parker or Jared Hughes. Certainly Craig Kimbrell would be a better option than those two guys here, or the way it would work is Hector Neris might get bumped down to the eighth inning, and you could have used Hector Neris tonight in the eighth inning to keep it a one-run lead, and maybe the Phillies don't score that a run in the top of the ninth. Maybe they go just as quietly, or maybe they try something different. You don't know, but you don't have Hector Neris in the eighth inning and Craig Kimbrell in the ninth inning. Instead, you're using Jared Hughes and Blake Parker and Mike Morin in these late-inning situations. They're not those kinds of guys, and the Phillies know that. And it's a mystery to me why they didn't go out and why they didn't do more at the trade deadline or just go out and sign Dallas Keuchel and Craig Kimbrell. It really doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. Well, up next, we're going to talk to Matt Winkleman about Johnny Almaraz. We're going to talk a little bit about Spencer Howard and whether or not he might be coming to Philadelphia. We'll do that next right here on Hittin' Season. Well, Johnny Almaraz, the Phillies' longtime director of amateur scouting, I'd been the director of amateur scouting since October of 2014, stepped down this week. He's going to take another role with the team, and he's been in charge of the Phillies' drafts for the last few years. And joining me to talk about the departure of Almaraz, and we'll talk a little Spencer Howard as well, is one of the most dialed-in guys on the Phillies' farm system and prospects. Matt Winkelmann, of course, you know him from Phillies' Minor Thoughts and also Baseball Prospectus. Matt, thanks for coming on Hitting Season once again. How are you, buddy?
I'm good.
Thanks, man. It's good to have you again. It's the perfect week to have you on because I want to talk to you about two things mainly, and we can get into some other stuff too, but I want to talk to you about Johnny Almaraz. We'll get into that in just a second, but first, Spencer Howard here on Wednesday night pitched in Redding's first playoff game of the fall, and even though Redding lost, they lost late after Howard had left the game, you were able to catch a good portion of the game that Redding played against Trenton. How did Spencer Howard look? Because the line was immaculate. It wasn't immaculate, but it looked pretty damn good.
It was immaculate for five and a third innings, but he looked really good. It was, the TV gun was a little bit off, but people at the game said he was up to 98. Fastball and changeup looked really good. Showed a good slider. Apparently didn't have his curveball feel for four or five innings. It's a bit of a loopy one, but guys were just laying back on it when they had to go catch up to the fastball. And I think his last pitch number 99 was 95 miles per hour for his 12th strikeout.
That's nice. I mean, and it's nice that he's got his pitch count up to near 100. That he's, because I know he missed the first part of the season, and obviously when you're working your way back and you've got a young arm like him, you don't want to overtax him early. So he's pretty well built up at this point in the season. But you know, the question I think a lot of Phillies fans are wondering, and Jim Salisbury wrote a little bit about this for NBC Sports Philadelphia today, kind of poo-pooing the idea, but Spencer Howard as a September call-up, once Redding's playoff run is done, is that a possibility? Salisbury seemed to be throwing a little bit of cold water on it, but it seems as though the Phillies might be leaving open the possibility of bringing him up in some kind of role. What do you make out of the Phillies potentially bringing up Spencer Howard?
I don't think they want to. I actually wrote about this last week for Baseball Prospectus. Right now, Howard with tonight, let me pull it up, is at 78 innings on the year. Mm-hmm. If they call him up, let's say regardless of whether they call him up now or not, he's got maybe one more double-A start if they advance, and he's probably going to get three or four in the majors. Let's say they call him up as a starter. Given their pitcher usage, let's say he's probably only got about another 20 innings. Puts him under 100.
Okay.
And they would be high stress, and then you'd probably want to shut him down after being in a playoff race in the majors. Versus right now, they can, if Redding advances, he'll get another start in Redding. If not, he'll probably get a start in Florida, and he'll go to the Arizona Fall League where they'll be able to monitor him. The Clearwater pitching coach is the coach of the Arizona Fall League team, and they could probably get him up near 110, 115 innings.
Mm-hmm.
And that factors into next year where you're talking about what is the innings jump from maybe 90, 95 to what you want, or 110, 115 to a full season. So the difference between him coming up now or not could be the difference between whether you get 150 innings and he's pitching into September and beyond, possibly, for the Phillies in the big leagues next year.
Well, I guess my question then would be, why not use him out of the bullpen? I realize that he's been starting this whole year, and it's a little bit of a different mindset, but if maybe you're only using him one inning at a time, you know, a couple times a week, does that make sense, or would that hurt his development?
I think that would hurt his development. I think right now, contrary to what you normally are doing with pitchers, you want him to throw innings.
Mm-hmm.
You want him to be building up his arm, pitching deep into the year. If he were to go to a bullpen role right now, he might not break 85 innings this year.
And they want to get him close to 90, 95, 100 innings before moving him on to the AFL?
Yeah, and if you moved him to the bullpen in the majors, then you'd have to try and re-ramp him up for Arizona Fall League. Maybe he's only a reliever there. I think if you're going to bring up Spencer Howard, the biggest impact is you put him in the rotation and you just hope he provides a spark. And I think what they're doing right now is, I think, hedging their bets. As long as he's pitching right now, they don't have to make a decision.
Right.
He was a little bit rough his last time out. His command has wavered as he started to get into the 70s and 80s pitch count wise. But let's say they close the gap, and in a week and a half, Redding is done in the playoffs, and the Phillies are a game out. I think the conversation starts to change a little bit more there.
Yeah.
But let's say it's a week and a half from now, Redding's done in the playoffs, and the Phillies are four games out.
Yeah. Or even three games out, like tonight. You know, yeah. I think you're still hedging your bets a little bit there. I mean, I would love to see it, because based on the reports of how well he's throwing and the stuff that he's displaying, I mean, how good would he be in this starting rotation at the moment? Given everything else the Phillies have in that starting rotation, would he be this team's second best starter?
I don't actually know. So this is a thing I also talked about last week. So far, it's not just that the major league balls and the AAA ball flies farther. It's actually a little bit slicker, and it's harder to throw. And the Redding guys have been throwing it in their bullpens, but none of them have actually used it in a game.
Oh, okay.
The Yankees' top pitching prospect, Davey Garcia, actually in his transition from AA to AAA, saw his walk rate and home run rate both spike, and his strikeouts come down, and they've been prepping him to go to the majors. No one's made the AA to the majors jump during the season, outside, I think, Jordan Yamada of the Marlins. So, I mean, stuff-wise, if Howard could throw all of his pitches like he is in AA right now in the majors, he's their second-best starter. But I think when Jared Eichhoff first came up and he didn't throw his curveball for his first four starts. So if you're talking about Spencer Howard with diminished command, maybe doesn't have quite the feel for the secondary pitches.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah,
that's Nick Pivetta.
Yeah, and that's not what you want. I mean, and that's the thing I don't think people are thinking a lot about. It's not something that I've been thinking a lot about, is the difference in the balls. Because for people who don't follow this that closely, AAA is using the same balls that the majors use, but the minor leagues from AA on down are using balls from last year and years before. So they're not using the juiced balls with the laces that are a little bit closer to the leather and the smoother leather. So we've seen a huge jump not only in the home run rate at the majors, but also in AAA. And so that's what Matt's referring to here, is that, you know, the minor league balls, the AAA guys are using stuff that's different from the AA guys, right?
Yeah. So AAA home runs across the board are up 60% this year.
That's a lot.
I think AA was at 90% of last year. So that's a huge gap.
Yeah.
And it's changed how people are pitching. So, I mean, they could bring him to the majors and he could be dynamite, but he could also crash and burn because they have no chance to have a couple starts while he eases in.
Well, let me ask you this. What are the chances you think he opens the season next year in the starting rotation?
I think they're still kind of low, but they're higher than him coming up this year. It really depends on what they do this offseason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think he's going to come to camp with at very least lip service to win a spot in the rotation.
I think that's fair. I think they have to leave that door open, but you're right. I think getting some experience with the AAA baseball or the major league baseball would help him at least kind of. I mean, and like you said, he is using it in the bullpens, but using it in a game is something totally different. But a very exciting outing from him on Wednesday night in Redding's first playoff game to, you know, your first ever playoff game in the minors, and
it's not his first.
That's because he threw a no hitter last year in the playoffs, didn't he?
He did, and then he followed that's it up right. with a bad back with like 5 2/3 of one run ball.
I barely got the sentence out of my mouth, and I had to reel it back in because I remembered. So Spencer Howard coming through in postseason performances. That's pretty cool. It would be great to see him in September. I would love to see it, but there are reasons, as Matt is mentioning, that it makes sense perhaps maybe to not jump the gun. And it won't happen if the Phillies continue to lose ground to the Chicago Cubs like they have after their loss here on Wednesday night. Let's move over to Johnny Almaraz, because I think a lot of people automatically, when they see someone has been removed from their position in the Phillies front office, they either automatically think they were fired or they automatically think this is a good thing. And in some cases, that's right. I think removing John Mailey was the right decision. With Johnny Almaraz, I don't think most people know exactly what he's in control of, how much control he has. When people complain about the drafts, they tend to only look at the first round picks and not anything else. But the first round picks are incredibly important. So I think we should talk about Almaraz and his tenure as a whole here. And let's start off with the good stuff first. What do you think Almaraz got right in his 5 years running amateur scouting?
So they really, the last few years, they went college early. And I mean, I don't think anyone's really complaining right now about Adam Haseley, Alec Bohm, or Bryson Stott. They got a lot better in, I know this is things that only like nerdy me cares about, day three of the draft, where you're talking about getting college juniors who maybe were already relievers or four-year starting pitchers that you're going to move to the bullpen, kind of those moves very much on the margins. And in the previous regime, especially once the whole slotting system got put into place, those were a lot of wasted picks. There was some nepotism picks late. And I will say, in fairness, the first year of Almaraz's draft, they took three nepotism picks to end it.
Was that the year they took Ruben Amaro's nephew or something like that?
They did, but he actually stuck around, and I think he's in the system for a bit. He was coaching. He was not one of those that I was talking about. They kept trying to draft him.
Because that was the last round that they took him. So that's the only one I remember that was a nepotism pick.
He was 35th round. 39th round was a Morandini, and the 40th round was a McCarthy.
Oh, that's right. It was McCarthy. That's the one I was thinking of. Yes, yes.
Now, I don't think the 2015 draft is a particularly good one. That was the Cornelius Randolph in the first round year. Mm-hmm. But Scott Kingery in the second round is going to at least give that draft legs. Yeah. I think Almaraz forever is going to be tied to that 2016 draft. Having the number one overall pick and walking out with Moniak, Gowdy, and Stobie and getting nothing for... looking like we're not going to get anything impactful for that.
Yeah.
That's not good.
Yeah. That's like the Sixers Markelle Fultz stuff. You know what I mean? Like you spend a whole year where you're in last place. You finish with the worst record in baseball and you have absolutely nothing to show for it, at least as far as draft position is concerned. And I guess, the question with that Moniak draft is you look at the first round picks from that year and virtually none of them appear to be high impact major league players, at least not yet. Nick Senzel, the only one that I think most people think has a chance to be a well above average major league player, but there are some others who I think have some potential, maybe dealt with some injuries early on. But with Mickey Moniak, it seemed to me that Almaraz and the Phillies kind of read the room and didn't really see anyone there to go all in on. So they went with Moniak because they wanted to spread some money around in the second and third rounds.
Yeah, and that actually factors into what I'll say is the biggest critique in a way of Almaraz is the Almaraz-Klintak draft room. And I'll say Almaraz-Klintak because the 15 draft was still under the Amaro era.
Okay.
But from 16 to 19, we're talking, at least the Phillies have some analytic structure around picking. You have Matt Klintak's people around, especially early, and you're talking about draft strategy of a number one overall pick. Everyone in the front office has an opinion.
Mm-hmm.
That's not Johnny Almaraz's pick to just make. So the idea to take Moniak, save money there. And I will say, as you said, the top of that draft was not good. The best picks may be Senzel. Gavin Lux just came up for the Dodgers. He was in the 20s of that first round. That's more of a collective. And I would say that the during that time period, 2016 to 2019, the Phillies were not really great with being too creative with draft slots and stuff. And some of that is they never had comp picks. And in that draft, the 2016 draft, they saved a bunch of money, but then they had to wait for their second round pick. Once a couple of the teams had already, notably the Reds and the Braves, who were at 2 and 3, had a comp pick And so floating that money down, they loved Kevin Gowdy. That's a Tommy John and a whole bunch of injuries to a high school pitcher. I can't really blame them for that. That just happens, and it sucks. It sucks for the player. It sucks for the team. But I don't think they've moved money around creatively. Now, we can say that whether that's good or bad. They did manage to save money on Alec Boehm in 2018 that they spent on Kendall Simmons and Dominic Pipkin, which both look somewhat positive. But there isn't that story that you see in the Braves system or the Dodgers system where you have all these comp round picks or these overslot guys late where the money was moved around to get a big name later. And that just could have been how drafts fell, but they never were too creative.
Well, I mean, and that's part of the issue is you want a guy in there who has a little bit of vision there with that. And, you know, I think when the Phillies brought Almaraz on board, he came from Atlanta. He ran the team's international scouting operation and oversaw the signings of Acuna Jr. and Albies. And under Almaraz, wasn't able to unearth anybody like that during his time here. Although, again, we will see what goes down.
I mean, I'll make an argument that they reached for. Spencer Howard was a reach in the second round of 2017, and they went under slot there. And the 2017 draft is the one that, if it turns around, could be the one that...
That's the Haisley draft, right?
Yeah, they went Haisley, Howard, Connor Siebold, who's a solid prospect in the third, Jake Schiner, who was sent out for Jay Bruce, you have Ethan Lindell, Nick Maton, Connor Brogdon was a guy who was thought about as a potential call-up. He was the 10th round pick that year. You have Kyle Doughy, Austin Listy, Damon Jones, Addison Russ was 16 to 19 that year. There's just a lot of, like, there was just a really good run of college guys late, and Spencer Howard in the second round could turn out to be the best pick of his time here.
Yeah. And those second round picks like Scott Kingery as well. I mean, he may end up being the best offensive player taken by Almaraz in any of these drafts, but we'll have to see how Boehm and Bryson Stott turn out. And, you know, to be fair with Moniak, he's still 21, or is he 22 now?
He's 21. He doesn't turn 22 until
AA.
Next May. Yeah.
Right. So he's still a baby in the particular league he's in. He's just been around forever because he was taken out of high school. But it's important to remember Moniak is still very young for his league and showed some signs of improvement this year. Although, again, I think the ceiling for him is somewhat limited, as you've written about and just about every other Phillies prospect writer has written about. As far as what the Phillies do next with their head of the amateur draft and amateur scouting, who do you think will replace him? Are they going to look for somebody from outside the organization, do you think?
I don't know, actually. It's really hard to get a read on the Phillies in any way. The only thing we know is that they're going to interview people, and one of those people will be the current second in command of their amateur drafts. But they don't really telegraph any of their moves, whether they are front office hires or trades or anything. So I think they could go outside. They could go inside. I think
it'll be interesting that if Gabe Kapler, if he's going to have any kind of influence, because, you know, he held this job a job similar to this in the Dodgers organization, and whether or not there's somebody from there. He's brought in so many of his other people in some of these coaching positions.
I would say it's actually more Klentak than Kapler. Klentak. Kapler's been very isolated to, I think, the major leagues, and I think a lot of his philosophies align with the overall organization philosophies. The guy who actually in the role that Kapler was in the Dodgers and the Phillies is Josh Bonifay, who came over from the Astros last offseason. I think they're going to want somebody who has some of their scouting philosophies. And it's hard to know entirely where they are. Drafts, we only get to see who they pick, not who they liked.
Yeah, true.
They tend to like high school bats or college bats early. Though I don't think that would have been the case this year had Stott not fallen. They go pitching heavy, but not pitching very early. But they also haven't had a second-round pick in 2 years. And if most of us have our way this offseason, they won't have one again this year.
That's right.
So it's hard to know. And I think when we're talking about scouting directors, they're tied directly to the player development. I think the best you can say is you hope that a draft isn't dead on arrival. You're not like everyone shows up in Clearwater and everyone's like, that was a first round pick. That would be the Joe Savory.
Yeah, right.
draft. But I think they were much deeper drafts under Almaraz. And I think he gave the player development staff a lot to work with. And we know that's been a problem for the Phillies when they're trying to correct. But these things tend to have some lag time.
So overall, how would you? I don't know if you want to give it a letter grade because I know that's a nebulous thing to do. But how would you sum up Almaraz's tenure here? Was it overall? Was it generally positive? Was it generally negative? Or just a real mixed bag?
I would say it's on the positive side. I wouldn't say it's amazing. There's not like a home run draft where you're sitting on superstars. I mean, that could change if Bohm and Howard and Stott are great or some other guys emerge later. I did talk about letter grades with somebody online. And I mean, if you went like B, B minus type, maybe even like C plus, that kind of like above average, you're not overwhelmed. It's not the Dodgers 2016 draft or some of the other organizations that have tended to really be exemplary. But it's a huge step up from whatever happened between Cole Hamels and J.P. Crawford. So I would say it's been good, and I think it's been a transition as the new front office has come in to.
Mm-hmm. Last thing for you, is there anything the amateur scouting department needs to do to get better under the new person? Is there anything that other clubs are doing that the Phillies should be doing that they haven't been doing, or do they just need to do their own things better or get luckier? You know, how do they get better at this?
So it's something that I have my own personal critique on is I think they've made some non-competitive early picks. I think of Colton Eastman in the fourth round of 2018, guys who are like command control college guys early, where there's that the ceiling there is back end starter. I think back to Cole Irvin in 2016, though he actually spiked in pro ball and then came back a bit. But I think there's been a little bit of extra safety that has occurred at the top of drafts. And I think they've fallen in love with some of the analytics buzzy things like spin rate on breaking balls a bit. And just, I think some of the same things that plague the internal scouting and the internal player evaluation, I think they've carried over a little bit into the amateur side. But I think the biggest problem with scouting has been taking the guys who show up in after the draft and improving them to be major leaguers.
Yeah, so more on the development side as opposed to necessarily the selection of these players. Once you select them, making them better?
Yeah.
okay.
Because even if like you're talking about bad picks, like you'd at least like to see growth over time.
Well, it's an interesting decision. It'll be interesting to see what direction they move in next as they look to replace Johnny Almaraz. And we'll certainly also look to see what the Phillies do with Spencer Howard once the Redding fighting season is done. Hey, folks, make sure you are checking out Matt Winkleman's work at Philly Minor Thoughts and also at Baseball Prospectus. And don't forget to follow Matt on Twitter. You probably already do, but if you don't, it's at Matt_Winkleman. Matt, thanks so much for coming back on Hittin' Season, buddy. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. It was fun.
Well, up next, we're going to talk about Bryce Harper saving his season, and I want to talk a little bit about Scott Kingery and some Phillies call-ups here for the month of September. We'll do that next right here on Hittin' Season. And we're back on Hitting Season. Let's talk a little bit about Bryce Harper, because we gave Bryce Harper a little bit of a hard time earlier in the season. I think it was during that San Francisco series, a series where the Phillies were playing the Giants out west, where I think I gave him a little bit of a hard time, probably more of a hard time than he deserved, but I had just grown frustrated with Harper. His seemingly how quiet he was most of the time. He would jump. He would have some big games here and there where he would have some clutch moments, no doubt about that. But for most of the time, for a lot of the time, it would just feel like Harper wasn't doing a whole lot. And so that was probably the most aggressively negative I've been about Bryce Harper during the course of the season. But Bryce Harper has absolutely having a legitimately hot second half, and now his numbers look about like what you would have expected at the beginning of the season. He has been proving his worth here over the last couple of months. I wrote about this for The Good Fight, but I wanted to reiterate it here on the podcast for those of you who didn't read it. And just note where we started with Bryce Harper. After an 0-for-4 against the Brewers on May 14th, his batting average had fallen to a season-low 219. But he had an on-base percentage of 370. Think about how much he was walking during that time. A batting average of 219, but an on-base percentage of 370 is unbelievable. But the slugging percentage of 432 was not what we had in mind when we signed him to the 13-year, $330 million contract. He was signed to be a thumper in the middle of the lineup. And he just wasn't doing that all that much. But things started to slowly stabilize for Harper after hitting that 219 mark from May 15th through July 31st. That's 65 games. He hit 272. The on-base percentage stayed the same, about 374, and the slugging percentage crept up near 500. It was 490. He had 11 home runs in those 65 games and had 47 RBIs and 864 OPS. And so those season numbers at the beginning of the year were dragging down his overall numbers, despite that 65-game run of competence. I wouldn't say that he was excellent during that time, but it was competent, highly competent. 864 OPS is pretty darn good. Now, on this day and age of Major League Baseball, with the balls flying out of the ballpark, everything juiced, not exactly at a superstar level, but a very good player when was having a good season. His season was going fine up to that point, despite my kvetching and complaining about it, okay? But in the series opener against the Reds on Monday, Harper hit his 30th home run of the season. It's only the third time in his career that he's gotten to 30 home runs. And then on Tuesday night, he knocked in his 100th run of the season, only the second time he's ever done that. Last season, when he hit 34 home runs and knocked in 100. That was the first time he'd ever knocked in 100 runs was last year. Entering play on Wednesday, Harper was hitting 256, with a 370 on base and a 502 slugging percentage. His season slugging percentage now up to 502 on the season coming into Wednesday with those 30 home runs, 100 RBIs, and 86 runs scored. His 3.6 Fangraphs wins above replacement is already higher than last year's 3.5. His weighted runs created of 123 is 11th among National League outfielders. But when you break down the numbers even more, they're even better. Before the All-Star break, he had a weighted runs created of 116 with 16 homers in just about 400 plate appearances. Since the break, he has a weighted runs created of 136. He's slugging 567. He has 14 home runs in 200 fewer plate appearances. So two fewer homers in 200 fewer plate appearances. And he's been worth 1.6 wins above replacement over that stretch. So again, in 200 fewer plate appearances, he's been worth 0.4 of a win above replacement less. All that to say, really, really good. And if we drill down even further, over the last 25 games, going back to August 3rd, again, coming into Wednesday night, Harper was hitting 289, 373 with a 680 slugging percentage, 12 homers in his last 25 games, and 28 RBIs in that stretch. That's an OPS of 1,053. Over the last 30 days, Harper has hit 11 home runs. Only Aristides Aquino from the Reds has 14, Nolan Arenado with 13, and Nicholas Castellanos and Freddie Freeman with 12 each have hit more home runs in the National League, and his 27 RBIs over that stretch is tied for third most in the National League. And a lot of the credit's being given to a toe tap that he's been instituting in his swing, and that happened before Charlie Manuel came over as hitting coach, but it's obviously helped. He's the first Philly since Ryan Howard in 2011 to hit 30 home runs and have 100 RBIs, and he's the last Phillies outfielder to do it since Pat Burrell in 2005 when he had 32 and 117. Jason Stark also noted that the only free agents in Phillies history with 30 or more homers and 100 or more RBIs in their first season after signing, Bryce Harper this year, and of course Jim Thome in 2003 when he hit 47 homers and had 131 RBIs. And this stat has been mentioned before as well. Harper's wins probability added, which again is a number that calculates how much win probability a player has had it as added with his at bats during the course of a season. His 5.13 wins probability added is sixth most in baseball. What that means is, suppose Harper comes to the plate in the ninth inning with his team down three runs, the Phillies' win expectancy might be 1%. They have a 1% chance of winning that game. If he hits a walk-off grand slam, the Phillies' chances of winning swing the other way to 100%, so Harper's wins probability added for that plate appearance, he moved the needle from 1% to 100%, so that's 0.99, a 99% swing, 0.99. So Harper's 5.13 WPA, sixth most in baseball. Now, all that to say he's been super-duper clutch. And his +3 defensive run saved is fourth most among MLB right fielders. Only four outfielders have more defensive assists than Harper's 9, so the defense has been there all season, too. JT Realmuto may be this team's MVP, but Bryce Harper is having exactly the type of season we were hoping, and it's probably going to go down as the second-best season of his career, which is, frankly, all we could have asked for. So kudos to Bryce Harper for turning things around, and we'll see what the month of September brings. He's going to keep adding to these numbers, one would hope. We should also talk a little bit about Scott Kingery, hitting .276, .337, .508 this season, again, coming into Wednesday night, 17 homers and 31 doubles. Over the last 15 days, he has a 1,067 OPS with three homers and three doubles. I think Charlie Manuel arriving has really helped him out, but he's been pretty good all season. He's projected to finish with 123 games played, 20 homers, 59 RBIs, and 37 doubles in just 123 games. If he was on a 162-game pace, he'd have 48 doubles, 26 homers, 78 RBIs, and 84 runs scored. That's an all-star. That's borderline silver slugger stuff right there for a second baseman. He's also got pretty interesting home road splits this year, Kingery does. He's actually hitting better on the road. 903 OPS on the road compared to a 783 OPS. Every number in his slash line higher on the road than at home, which is, I think, a good sign that he's comfortable on the road. He doesn't rely on Citizens Bank Park to inflate his numbers. It could just be a one-year fluctuation or aberration or whatever. We'll have to see as his career goes along, but I think it's a good sign that he seems comfortable hitting on the road and had a home run in the Cincinnati series. So, again, continuing with that trend of hitting well on the road. Before we finish up here, let's also talk a little bit about some of the Phillies call-ups that could be coming in September. You heard just a minute ago us talk about, will Spencer Howard get the call-up? Again, I would love to see it, but as Matt Winkleman noted just a minute ago, probably not going to happen, especially if the Phillies continue to fall further out of the wild card chase. You want him to be ready to go for 2020. I think 2020 is more important with Spencer Howard than 2019 at this point. I don't want to do anything to mess up 2020. If the Phillies can bring up Spencer Howard and have him make a couple of starts and it doesn't foul things up for next season, then I say do it. But if it is going to mess with his development, if Matt's right and it is going to be something that sets him back, especially going to the bullpen, which now sounds like an idea that I wouldn't be behind, I would probably just let him finish the season, go to the Arizona Fall League, get a few dozen more innings under his belt, and then get ready to come into spring training in March of next year and compete for a spot in the Major League rotation. Again, probably won't happen. He'll probably start in AAA, but I think Spencer Howard is a part of this big league rotation. I think most people think he's a part of the big league rotation next year. So you got to do whatever you need to do in order to make it, you know, make sure that he is ready to go for 2020. A couple other names to mention here as September call-ups. Nick Pivetta was called back up. It looks like the Phillies will call up Michael Franco. When he's eligible to return, he has to stay in the minors for 10 days before he's eligible to come back up. But Nick Williams has been called back up. So just about everybody on the 40-man roster has made their way back up to the majors. And listen, some of these September games, they're going to be pretty awful, guys. I'm just going to tell you flat out. Because Gabe Kapler is going to use every player on his bench. Now, these roster rules change next year. The 40-man rosters are going to go away in September of next year. They're going to go to 28-man rosters because during the course of the season, the rosters will increase by man from 25 to 26. And in September, managers will get an extra two guys to play with, and they'll go to 28. But no more of this having 20 guys in the bullpen. No more having a bench of 12 guys. You know, that just, it's not, it doesn't make any sense that baseball's rules are so different in the month of September than the rest of the season, the most important month of the season. It's ridiculous. And Gabe Kapler is going to use all the guys, all the bullets that he has. I mean, that makes sense. I can't blame the guy for it, especially as he's fighting for a wild card spot. But, you know, in this particular situation, I'm very happy to, I can't wait for Major League Baseball to stop managers from making the game less watchable, because that's what September baseball has become. It's become almost unwatchable with all of the pitching changes and the different players and all that. I get why they do it. I don't blame them for doing it. I'm not mad at Gabe Kapler for doing it. It's just the way baseball is. Unfortunately, it needs to change, and it will change starting next year. All right, let's get to our stat of the week, and I actually have two stats of the week for you here. This is from Matt Gelb in Baseball Reference, noting that in the game on Wednesday night, Logan Morrison and Jay Bruce both hit pinch-hit home runs. It's the first time the Phillies have hit two pinch-hit home runs in the same game since 1958. That's crazy. Rip Rapolsky and Bob Bowman were the last to do it. I can't believe that it's been that long since the Phillies have had two pinch-hit home runs in the same game. And then one other stat, this coming from Stats by Stats, by the Twitter feed at Stats by Stats. Michael Lorenzen of the Reds is the first player to earn the win, hit a home run, and play in the field in the same game since Babe Ruth did it with the Yankees back in June of 1921. Michael Lorenzen did all of that in the Wednesday night game against the Phillies. That home run pushed their lead from one run to three runs, and also pitched an inning, got the win, played in the field. Michael Lorenzen's a phenomenal athlete. The fact that he's able to do that, he's Ichiro light is what he is. He's not quite, not Ichiro, I meant Shohei Ohtani. He's Shohei Ohtani light. He's not Shohei Ohtani. Can't do exactly what Ohtani can do, but it's about as close as you can get without being Shohei Ohtani. So, pretty impressive feat by Michael Lorenzen of the Cincinnati Reds. And folks, that will do it for episode number 316 of Hittin' Season. My thanks to Matt Winkleman for coming on the podcast. Again, just a general reminder, folks, if you haven't done so, make sure to subscribe to the Good Fight podcast feed at Apple Podcasts or Spotify, wherever it is you get your podcast. Make sure you check out thegoodfight.com. Check out all the written material we have going on up there. Lots of great writers at The Good Fight keeping you up to date on the latest Phillies news and information as the Phillies continue this so-called pennant race here in the month of September. And again, don't forget to check out the Hittin' Season Patreon. That is at patreon.com/hittin'season. Thanks everybody for tuning in. I'll talk to you all next time right here on Hittin' Season.